You know, if you were going to tell someone about Christian faith, you wouldn't use this gospel text. You might, talk to them about a miracle of Jesus or walk on the water or what he taught us about loving God and loving neighbors or something. But Jesus goes up a mountain, meets two dead guys, shines like the sun. It's not for public consumption. It's for the in-house people to understand the mystery of what has happened here. It is for us. It was for the disciples, not for the crowds. And so we turn to that, this mysterious text today, with that spirit of saying, this is for the people who are all in, who want desperately to follow Jesus, even up that mountain. Pray with me. Lord Jesus, we ask that you would open your word to us, that the mystery of your transfiguration might become plain to our eyes. Show us the vision you have for our living, that we might serve you and love you more. In Christ's name we ask. Amen. So you have often heard it said that life imitates art instead of the other way around. Now, if a painting of a bowl of fruit is art imitating life. But you could say, like, Jesus' profound story of the prodigal son is art, in this case a parable, that is imitating life, like real fathers and sons and family relationships and things like grace and forgiveness and deep human hurts and the God who heals them. Then you have Rembrandt's masterful painting of the return of the prodigal son. So that would be art imitating life imitating art. Which takes imitation to the next level. Because it's in the imitation of things that we define our desires and our values and we name our and claim our beliefs or what we find beautiful or where we find our hope. Why else would we imitate something? So when life imitates art, it means that people are seeking to become or possess or experience what they see in art or watch on TV or find in a movie or find in a story. Now think of the popularity of the movie The Black Panther and the countless children, especially young African-American kids, emulating heroes and finding strength and hope against their personal adversities because they watched an art form. But then you could think of the truly terrible things you could see on TV, like The Bachelorette, or, people behaving really badly that people want to emulate. Those macho movies on TV that seem to give people license to be selfish or violent or racist or dysfunctional. We want to be what we see on the screen. That's why it's on the screen, by the way. Now what, though, think, what salacious work of fiction or farce could compare to what we see in Washington? Not going there, but just think about it. Now, what author could imagine or photographer depict the realities of corruption in business or violence in the world? Imagine a writer going to a publisher with a novel idea about a pharmaceutical company that makes an incredibly addictive drug like OxyContin, knowingly addicting thousands of people and causing hundreds of deaths so they could make millions of dollars. Who would believe a story like that? Or a story about Venezuela or Syria or a dozen other places where dictators kill their own people or powerful millionaires getting involved in prostitution and sex trafficking? Who would believe stories like that? How can art imitate life when life seems too bizarre to be believed? I think artists just throw up their hands and say, yeah, I got nothing here. Okay, I'm going to stop the ranting, but I think that the single greatest reason why people in the world find it difficult to believe in God is that people in the world have made the world too impossible to comprehend. How could there be a God who allows such insanely sinful things to happen? A God who's supposed to care for us, yet allows this kind of evil and suffering and perversion to exist. How do we make sense of our lives? How do we find purpose and meaning and value in who we are? How do we figure out ourselves when life in this world is so hard to understand? I don't blame anyone for not believing in God. I just wish I could help them to find a way. Now, it is often true that life imitates art, but I've always felt it more true that life imitates religion. People make up their own way of worshiping or find their own kinds of faith communities to belong to and their own gods to believe in. If you don't believe me, just think Fenway Park or Gillette Stadium. Thousands of religious fanatics, and that's where we get the word fan, by the way, believing against all odds that miracles can occur. And if you live in Boston, it happens a lot. People have their own rituals, their own belief systems, whether or not they belong to a religious community. For many people, religion, their personal religion is really about good luck, good fortune, keeping harm from happening to us and our kids. It's more like, their religion is more like a talisman or magical thinking that will make life go their way. Now, I sent this sermon plan out on Monday to our team. And then on Tuesday, I was sitting in my dentist's office thinking about this. And on the way home, a remarkable thing happened. National Public Radio was playing a story about workism, about how modern people, and actually millennials in particular, are making work their religion. People are looking to their jobs to be the source of fulfillment for their lives, to bring them passion and purpose and pleasure, which for the majority of people is bound to disappoint. As they noted, jobs are created to make money for people and not to provide fulfillment. If you can find both, you're among the few fortunate. They called their segment the Gospel of Work. And they noted that many people, especially young people, make their work their highest commitment in life to the detriment of other pursuits like family and community and personal enjoyment. Pardon me. Many people make shrines out of their workplaces, especially their cubicles. But they surround themselves with inspiring quotes and pictures. They meet in small groups, and they decide on missions they're going to be committed to together. Doesn't this sound like church? One author even quoted a book that was deeply influential to me about 1,000 years ago. And that is Max Weber's book that I read in the 60s. It's called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. And Weber said that the entire American philosophy of work and success, was based on the Puritans' work ethic, that all work was service to God, and that success, therefore, was equated with God's blessing, and failure in work was equated with his judgment. And not working, therefore, was sinfulness, it was sloth. So people poured themselves into their work religiously, striving for success not just for prosperity, but as an act of worship and to prove to other people that they were good and righteous and had meaning and value in the world and they were favored by God. Now, the authors are saying that this same spirit is unconsciously driving people today in their work, only without the God part. Their work is becoming their religion, a desperate attempt to find meaning and fulfillment in life. And people are simply trying to make sense of their lives in this confusing world, and they're looking for their jobs to do that for them. Not likely. Instead, they see disillusionment, depression, and anxious desperation to find some other kind of solution or an escape. It was a fascinating program, but I can know what you're thinking. Gee, Pastor Chris, I'm about to die from boredom, but I'm intrigued to know what this has to do with Jesus going up that mountain. Well, I'll tell you. When I was in seminary, more boredom coming just now. When I was in seminary, my thinking about God, which is called theology, was deeply influenced by a theologian named Wolfhart Pannenberg. And if you're planning on having more children, that is a wonderful name. But Pannenberg said that we cannot know anything about God or life from above where God is. We can only know from our perspective here below. So all our thinking, all our theology is from below, We can't know what God is thinking or how he sees things. It's all from a human point of view. We can speculate about the nature of God or the meaning of life, which, by the way, is called speculative theology or philosophy. But we cannot know anything about God from below unless what is from above is revealed to us, like Moses at the burning bush or Moses receiving the commandments at Sinai. Something from above has been revealed to us below. Pardon me. But therefore, then, what do you think is, what was the most important, crucial revelation of what was above coming to us here below? Christmas, of course. The incarnation of God in human life. The intimate, ultimate connection of everything above to everything below. Now, Jesus, therefore, in a sense, becomes our access to a knowledge, a view of our life and our meaning and our purpose from God's perspective. For instance, on a very personal note, from below, from living in this world, you might see yourself exactly the way the world has taught you to feel about yourself, as being weak and unworthy, not pretty enough, not smart enough, not capable enough, not worthy of being loved or valued, unless, of course, you find a job that would make you feel wonderful about yourself and enable you to buy all the things that the world says you must get to feel successful and fulfilled. But if you could see yourself from above, the way God sees you, you would know that you are absolutely and unconditionally loved. That you are infinitely valued, and not just some person living in the world, but a child of God, a citizen of his kingdom, and a precious part of the ministry of Jesus here below. That we can know, we can see, because Jesus has taught us to see that. Which brings us to another insight from Pannenberg, as I know you were hoping. Wolfhart said there were two kinds of truths. Descriptive truths, which means the things that we can know about the world, like the sky is blue and politicians can't agree on anything, things like that. And doxological truths, doxa meaning glory in Latin, like the doxology. Doxological truths, which means the things we can only know because we worship God. Things we can only know because we are here. Because we believe in Jesus. So now we get to go up that mountain with him. But just prior to this event in Matthew 17, in Matthew 16, Peter had spoken for all the disciples and confessed that they believed that Jesus was the Messiah, the Son of God. This faith had been growing inside them as they followed Jesus for almost 3 years. But not just because they saw the miracles. It was because they came to know him, to love him, and to feel his love. Doxological truth. They worshipped him. And they understood things they couldn't have understood before. Like that his love for them was the very love of God. Can't learn that in a book. If you read in Matthew 16, you hear that Jesus says to him, "Bingo, Pete. You figured it out, but not on your own. My Father in heaven revealed this to you." Jesus was saying that faith in him is not a truth we can know from below, from just our human experience, because it is the truth that comes to us from above, from God, his gift. So Jesus then invites Peter, James, and John to come from below to join him above. Now, we can know from what Jesus said after this mountaintop experience why he went up there in the first place. He was seeking confirmation of his mission, that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer and die for the sins of the world and then be resurrected. Now, listen carefully to this. Just as we try so hard to figure out our lives in this world, what we're supposed to do, who we're supposed to love, how to deal with hardships or suffering or uncertainty, how we're supposed to serve, how we can heal from our hurts, how we can hope for the future, how we can face death, how we can face life. Because Jesus is just as fully human as we are, he needed to figure that all out too. And so he went to God, to his Father, to see his life and his purpose as God sees it. And he invited his friends like us to come and see too. So the four friends ascend the mountain. The disciples think that once again Jesus was getting away from the world so he could pray to God in peace. They could not have foreseen what was about to happen. Jesus begins to pray, and they watch their friend's face, their Lord's face, begin to shine. as Moses did when he stood in the glory of God. But the light wasn't shining on him. The light was shining in him. It was coming from him. And in that shining, Moses appeared, and Elijah too. Moses, the friend of God, the lawgiver, and Elijah, the greatest prophet of God. Come to speak with the Son, the Beloved, the Christ of God. I can't even imagine what an incredible experience of holiness that must have been for them, where heaven and earth meet in one sacred space, like right here. A revelation so profound and joyous that Peter just wanted it to last forever, and so he blurts out something inane, and he says, "Lord, this is awesome. How about if I build three tents for you guys so I can shield you from the light?" Realizing the light was coming from Jesus, they were all surrounded in that moment by a cloud of light that Moses knew well. He had seen it on Sinai. It was the Shekinah, the presence of God. And from the glory, the voice spoke. And God said, "This is my Son, the Beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." Now, begging God's forgiveness, I have to confess that I think that last part was kind of unnecessary. After such a holy and very impressive experience, I think Peter and the others would pretty much pay close attention to Jesus from now on. But we know that isn't true, don't we? Peter would soon lose his faith and deny Jesus, and the others would all run away in fear when the light went out and the world got dark. It's the same for all of us. It's easy to trust in God and be willing to obey. When we feel God and we feel good, when we have faith and love and hope in our hearts. But when it gets dark in the valleys of life, when we're hurt or afraid or confused, when we feel broken or rejected, when we're suffering or lonely or just too sad to see God, we lose faith, we lose heart, we lose hope. And nothing in the world makes sense from down here. Least of all, sacrificing ourselves on serving God, or risking ourselves on loving other people, on being and doing what God sees that our life is about, that makes no sense to us. The disciples hear the voice. They hit the dirt, trembling with fear, because that's what happens on holy ground. I've often said that theologian Rudolf Otto called this the mysterium tremendum et fascinans, the mystery that causes us to tremble with wonder and terror and yet be drawn to it, fascinated like a moth to a flame. But even the highest and holiest moments of our lives must come to an end, and we have to go back to our real lives, our relationships and responsibilities, the choices we have to make, the problems we face, the changes before us, the needs all around us, and somehow try to figure out the meaning of our life in the midst of all that is hard and confusing in the world. So Jesus did what he often does. He tells his friends not to be afraid. Important takeaway from Jesus today. Don't be afraid of anything. Don't be afraid. I'm with you. Then he leads them down the mountain. And what did they do? I mean, go out for Chinese food and talk about the great theological experience they had just had? No, they got right back to work. With a man with the needs of God's people, a father whose son was sick, and disciples who needed to learn to trust the power of faith. Then Jesus tells them again that he must go to Jerusalem and die. And this time there's no protest from Peter or the others, because now they had seen Jesus from above. From God's perspective, and though they were deeply distressed, they trusted in him. And though they would fail him, they would get another chance to redeem themselves, and they would give their lives to take it. Now, when Jesus died, and they thought their light had gone out forever, they were lost in the dark of their loss and their pain and their fear and their doubt about God, as we've all been perhaps too many times. But when they saw his face again, that face that shined with the light of God's love, they knew. And when he left them to return to the heaven, the above, from which he had come, they found that his light was still shining in them, even now. And no matter how hard or confusing the journey would be, that light would never go out. And in that light, they began to see their own lives from above, because they knew that Jesus was watching them, as Jesus was seeing them, and Jesus was calling them his beloved, his friends, his fellow servants, his lovers of his people, and fulfillment of his mission. That is our real purpose in life. No matter what the world has taught us to believe, no matter what job we have, is to be the people that God sees us as. So how do you see your life? How do you figure out what you're supposed to do? What choices you should make for your future? Who you should value? What you should commit yourself to in the precious time of your life? Faith in Jesus always invites us up that mountain to see our lives from God's perspective. And by the way, God looking down on us with his perspective doesn't mean that God has ordained a particular thing for your life that you must do and find and follow, or you failed. Not at all. God offers us myriad possibilities for us to serve him in our lives, to experience him, whatever our jobs might be. He creates connections with people that we can choose to make, relationships we can choose to pursue or not, opportunities to serve and show compassion, causes us for us to commit to. We don't have to, but we can. We can for his kingdom purpose. Now, sometimes these are going to seem real obvious, like Sandy's call to Uganda, which happened to be precisely what her heart most desired. For me, I don't know what my mission in the future is going to look like, but I'm determined that it will be to use my life to serve God's people with faith and compassion, because that's my heart, and God knows that heart. So what will your life look like? What choices will you make about how you will live and who you will love and how you will serve God, or even what job you'll do? The gospel gift of the transfiguration of Jesus is to know that he is our access to God's perspective on our life. And so much more will become clear to us when we are willing to climb that mountain up to that spiritual vantage point to see what truly matters, what is really valuable, what sacrifices are worth the cost, what love is worth the risk, what chances we can take to be faithful to him and devoted to other people. Now, whatever we would be and do, the Apostle Paul makes the heart of it as clear as the light of day. In 2 Corinthians, he said that every believer, if you believe this much, mustard seed, then you have seen the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. He said that even though we have this treasure in earthen jars, and that means clay pots, which are fragile and easily broken, and yet we are called to carry this light of love and hope to everyone we can, even if it leaks out, maybe I think especially if it leaks out through the broken places of our lives. Because who is better to minister with love to someone in pain but someone who has known pain or loss or brokenness or sin too well? But above all, no matter what job we make or choices we make, the will of the God who loves us from above will make the life of Jesus visible in our bodies. That is our first and truest priority, to be a vessel that brings that life and love and forgiveness and grace into someone else's life, the welcome and the hope of belonging to Jesus. I share this experience with you. I was deeply troubled for my own reasons this week at one moment, and I was just in a dark mood, and I went into Starbucks, and there was a woman in front of me, and she had a little girl on her shoulder, but her face was turned the other way. And she was doing that thing little kids do where they hide their face and digging into her mom's coat, you know, because there were strangers around and everything, and she was fussy and everything. And the woman paid, and then when she turned around to walk away, the girl's face was now looking at me. And she just lifted up her head, and her face brightened, and her eyes were wide, and she smiled at me for absolutely no reason. And it absolutely transformed my life in that moment. I was filled with joy, was filled with love. If a one-year-old can bring that kind of joy with a simple smile on their face, Imagine what your face, your loving, kind face, could mean to someone else. It looked like the face of Jesus. It's exactly what he's talking about. Just that shining light in your life. To do that, we have to climb a mountain away from the world. And you've already driven up this mountain today to get up here. And to find on that mountain a table set in the presence of God, so that we can receive the life and love of our Lord Jesus again. For it is now our sacred privilege to celebrate the sacrament of the Lord's Supper.